My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Happy Halloween, and welcome to the second part of our Halloween Mysteries and Monsters double bill. This time, I'm keeping this episode local, as I'm joined by Dr. David Clark, author, lecturer, former journalist, UFO investigator, and folklorist. We discuss Sheffield's most infamous ghost story on the Stocksbridge Bypass. Since 1987, reports of chilling paranormal encounters have been reported by a variety of people from very different backgrounds. We look back on the best witnesses and put to bed some of the bypass's most notorious urban myths and exaggerations. Dr. Clark has also allowed us permission to include his original interview with the police officers involved, which you can hear after the interview on this episode. Before that, don't forget to follow us on social media. Please leave us a nice review on your podcast app to help us reach more like-minded souls, and subscribe to us on YouTube. Now, let me take you on a Halloween journey to the outskirts of my hometown to visit the ghosts of Stocksbridge Bypass. My guest today is author, lecturer, former journalist, and the man responsible for the MOD releasing their UFO files, Dr. David Clark. David, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Well, thank you for inviting me on. It's an honour.
Hey, it's very welcome. Thank you very much. So, here we are, Halloween.
Almost.
Almost, yes, almost upon us. As residents of Sheffield, I thought it would be only fair to have a chat about probably our most infamous local legend of ghostly goings-on, which is Stocksbridge Bypass. Now, this is a case you've had quite a bit of involvement with over the years and dealt with. So, first of all, just introduce yourself a bit, Clarity, and then we'll dive into the case.
Yeah, well, this is one of the actual very first stories that I sort of went out in the field to investigate, so to speak. This is, at the time, I was more into UFO sightings, and there was a big flap going on, 1987-88. There was loads and loads of things being, odd things seen in the sky over South Yorkshire, West Yorkshire. It seemed like virtually every day there was something going on. So I was zooming around all over the place in my little Datsun Cherry. I was a student at the time. I was studying archaeology, and I was sort of trying to sort of find time in between going on digs in different parts of the country to do all these paranormal investigations. And I was angling to, I was sort of training to be a journalist as well, because I just thought there's no jobs in archaeology. The only other thing I can do is write and interview people. So I've got it here in my hands, actually, the original cutting from the Sheffield Star. And it was on the front page of the Sheffield Star. Stamped on the back of it, it says 21st of September 1987, and the headline was Ghost Sightings on New Road, exclusive by Bob Westerdale, who would end up actually being my boss when I actually started working at the Star a couple of years later.
Yeah.
And it basically says, terrified security guards called in police and a clergyman after spotting ghosts on a £14 million bypass being built near Sheffield. A sergeant and police constable sent to the scene near Stocksbridge later said they felt a presence as they patrolled, but South Yorkshire police have refused to comment on the incident, and this is a bit I love, on reports that the panda car was jolted by mysterious thuds. So, of course, as soon as I saw this, my ears just pricked up, and I thought, I'm out there. So I think it must have been the following day or the day after, I got on straight onto the phone to the police, introduced myself as some hotshot trainee journalist who was interested in weirdness. And I remember the police constable, Dick Ellis, who I got to know quite well, who was one of the key witnesses, he just sort of said, oh, come up to Stocksbridge Police Station. And I distinctly remember parking outside in my battered, rusty green car and hauling this, you know, like the huge sort of ghetto blasters that people used to have those days.
Yes.
Because that's what I used to record my interviews on. None of your digital voice recorder nonsense that hadn't even been thought of. So yeah. I just hauled this huge tape recorder, and I remember sitting in the police station and talking to Dick Ellis, and he just told me the whole story, and I got it all on tape, I've still got that C90 tape, which I've had digitized, and you've got that, Paul, haven't you? You're free to use, you know, your listeners can have an exclusive access to the original account. And the interesting thing about that is this is Dick Ellis talking about what he'd seen with his mate. I can't remember the name of his special constable guy he was with.
John Beat.
That's him. Yeah. I didn't meet him on the first night, but I met him, I think, a few years later when Michael Aspel came to Stocksbridge to film an episode of his Strange But True that featured it. So that's when I got to meet John Beat several years later. But I did go up in a cop car with Dick Ellis onto the bypass, and it was a couple of nights after they'd had their experience. And I remember sitting there, it was freezing cold, it must have been... must have been about midnight, and thinking, "Oh my God, are we going to see something here?"
Yeah,
we didn't, but it was a very spooky experience, you know. And I'm convinced to this day. I mean, as you know, Paul, I'm a notorious skeptic about these things, but I'm convinced that something very mysterious, unexplained, happened. I don't know what.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about. The original, because obviously what caused the police to, obviously Dick and John to go up there, was that there'd been two construction workers who, I think they were called, was it David Goldthorpe and Stephen Brooks?
Yes, it was, yeah. They were working for a Rotherham security company called Constant Security, and I did speak to their managing director, a guy called Mike Lee, who was a former Rotherham policeman, and I worked in Rotherham for years as a journalist, and I knew all the CID and the police there, and you know, I got to talk to this guy, and he was absolutely convinced that something. I mean, I've got my original notes from the interview I did with him shortly afterwards here, and he said he said in all my experience I have never seen or heard anything remotely weird, but this sighting was definitely peculiar. So he was their boss, and he said he remembered being called out at 4:30 in the morning. So this is a few days before the police went up there and had their experience, and he said he saw these two hysterical men who were totally out of it. They said they had been driving along the bypass and had seen some children in medieval costume dancing around a bush.
Yes.
They drove past them and tried to turn round by a bridge that was only half finished at the time. And I remember that bridge when I went up with the police. So if you can imagine, if you know this Stocksbridge bypass as it is now, it was just like a huge muddy path that had been carved out of the hillside. It was nothing like the dual carriageway all full of lights and cameras like it is now.
Yeah.
And sat in the middle of it was, if you can imagine, a bridge without the ends on it. So it was like a half-constructed bridge that you couldn't get onto. It was just sat in the middle of the road. So we sat, and that's what we looked at. And that's where the police had their experience. But before that, the police had spoken to these two security guards, and according to what Mike Lee said, they'd seen something like a huge white shape come over the bridge towards them as if to attack them. Now, reading what he told me, That is a different account to the one the police said, because they said that they'd seen what looked like a hooded monk standing on the bridge. That's my memory of what the police told me. And when you listen to the tape, you'll hear what they say.
Yeah.
And my memory is that the security guards thought it was someone who was trespassing on the site, because it was open. You could get on there. And so what they did, they drove up in there. I think they had one of these 4x4s, a Land Rover or something, turned the headlights of the Land Rover on the bridge, and they saw this figure on the bridge, and then it just sort of vanished. So he described them as, apparently they'd fled from the scene and went banging on the door of the vicar in Stocksbridge to try and get some help from him, and I don't think they got very far with that.
Yeah.
But he's... The interesting thing was that apparently they wanted him to do an exorcism or something of the bridge, and he wouldn't do it or something, and he went to the police instead. There's a whole story about that, which we can go into later. But Mike, their boss, Mike Lee, he said that they were tough, no-nonsense workmen who would not normally be upset by anything, but they were very frightened indeed by what they thought they'd seen. Someone suggested that there may have been a graveyard up there at one time, and that the new road had disturbed it, but we looked into that theory, and it seems that was not the case. And I think that's really important, because of all the nonsense that's emerged in more recent years about, you know, graveyards being disturbed, mining accidents, all this kind of stuff.
Yep.
There was no graveyard up there. It was just virgin countryside. It was just fields.
Yep.
And Mr. Lee said that he went on to the road the following night, ghost hunting with the on-call manager, Peter Owens, who now works for Securico, but they didn't see anything. But the police went up and did see something. But it's interesting then, he says, Mr. Lee says he does not believe in ghosts, but I always think policemen and security guards are very unimaginative people. When something like this happens, it makes you scratch your head. My two former employees were basic, fit, down-to-earth South Yorkshire lads, one of whom was a rugby player and weightlifter. But 24 hours after the sighting, they were both still shaking with shock and their nerves are gone. Mm. Both left soon afterwards. So they both packed their jobs in at this at this firm, left. We understand one of the men is in Canada and the other still lives locally, but neither has worked since this happened. This isn't something I wrote in 1994.
Yeah.
But you can usually tell if people are kidding or winding you up, but this was unique in my experience. No one speaks about it at this company, but it's only because of the Michael Aspel television show that we've started talking about it. So that was like 1994.
Yep.
And the actual incident happened in 1987.
Yeah.
So what I was told by PC Ellis is that the security guards had come to them after going to the vicar, and the vicar couldn't do anything about it. So they the usual banter and joking and you know, ghosts and things that go bump in the night. So Dick Ellis went up with John Beat, and they sat in this car. It's in a similar position to where the security guards had been. And it was just, I mean, there was nothing there. You can imagine two banks of earth on either side, an unfinished road, pallets and bits of boxes and piles of stones and stuff that they were using to construct the road, and this unfinished bridge, P. Roy Bridge, if you know that, which has now become known as the Ghost Bridge. and I think they'd been sat there for ages and nothing had happened, and then they started seeing what looked like a shadow or something that was moving over one of the pallet boxes that was sitting on the bridge. That's my understanding. I'm just looking at my account now, which is based upon the interview I did with them. So they sat in the car. This must have been about midnight. Mm. Turned all the lights off and all the radios off. It was a clear night, clear sky with a virtual full moon. And after a while, we could see really clear because their eyes got acclimatized to what they were looking at. And we'd been sat there a couple of minutes, and up by the bridge, there was this large painted pallet box, and we could both see a shadow moving across it. So he said he got out of the car, flashed his lights on the box, but nothing could be seen.
Mm.
Got back in the car, shadow appears again, same thing happened. So this happened two or three times, and the police began to wonder if it was the lights from the steelworks below, because Stocksbridge is in the valley below, and they're building the road across the top of the hillside.
Yeah.
And basically, the whole reason for the bypass was because before the bypass, everyone who wanted to get from Sheffield out towards the Pennine Moors, towards the Woodhead Pass where you go over to Manchester, had to drive right through the streets to Stocksbridge. So it was to take all the traffic away. And they spent something like £13 million on this bypass. So steelworks below, lights from the steelworks, and they thought maybe that's what's causing the moving shadow. And so he then said, we'd been sat there for about 20 minutes. It was a nice night. He put his window down. Suddenly, I had a peculiar feeling, not like I'd ever had before, because we had been working nights for a long time, just as if someone had walked over my grave. And I remember him describing this, and you know that sort of like horrible feeling when you feel like the hairs at the back of your neck,
yeah,
prickling, like somebody's watching you or something. So I remember him describing having that feeling that he was being watched. And he said that both of them, they didn't tell each other at the time, but after when they discussed it, they both had the same sensation at the same time, and he went cold. And then a few seconds after, I had another feeling that someone was standing at the side of me, and I could see there was something stood by the side of the car. So you can imagine the terror that he was seeing.
Absolutely.
But he turned around, there was nothing there, and it was then at that moment that his colleague, this is John B, lets out such a scream and hits him on the arm. And then he looks around and there's someone standing next to the car, but behind his colleague. So all I could see was his torso. So if you can imagine looking out of a car window and there's someone who was obviously quite tall standing by the side of the car, but he couldn't see the head. He could just see the central part of the body. So by the time it had registered with him that there was someone there, it had gone again, and there was no way that anyone could have approached us without seeing them, because they could see up and down the road. They'd have obviously seen, if someone came down the bank, which was just mud, they'd have spotted them straight away.
Absolutely.
So after that happened, they drove up to the bridge, parked and radioed to the colleagues in Deep Car to come and join them. But then, whilst they were actually talking on the radio, something else happened. We'd been sat in the car for a few seconds, and then something thumped on the back of the car. And it's, if you watch the Michael Aspel show, they do a reconstruction of this, and it is hilarious.
Yes, it is. It's just them two screaming, going, ah, yeah, yeah. Bless him.
But it says, again, there was nothing at all about. We could see too well, and we were out too quick to check it. The car didn't physically shake, but something hit it. And when this happened, that was enough then. Then they drove back down into Deep Car to the police station. So they got like a bit of light-hearted ribbing from the colleagues. But they were so disturbed about it that they made an official report to headquarters, South Yorkshire Police. Now, you as a police officer, you would not do that.
No.
Unless, you know, something definitely had happened. You wouldn't put your reputation and your career at risk by, you know, actually filing a report. The thing is, I never got hold of that report. I mean, it was obviously as a result of them putting that in that Bob Westerdale found out about it, because this is what journalists do. Every morning you ring up the police and you say, what happened? You know, have you got anything for us? So obviously that next morning Bob must have been on the phone, or somebody else must have been and spoke to someone in the police press office. This is an era. Things are very different today, folks, because if something like this happened today, you'd never hear about it. Because the police aren't allowed to talk to journalists anymore. You have to do it through the press office, and they only tell you about things they want you to know. But back then, I mean, this is what I did for a job for years. Every morning I'd be in at sort of 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be on calls duty, and I would spend hours just phoning every single police station in South Yorkshire, every single ambulance station, every single fire station, and all the people you spoke to, coppers, ambulance drivers, firefighters, they'd all talk to you. And you'd be able to say, right, what jobs were you on yesterday? And they'd just look in the log and they'd tell you there was none of this, oh, no, we can't tell you about this, or we can't tell you about this, or you'll have to speak to the press office. So that is how you found out about things in those days.
Yeah.
So that's how it got into the paper. And that's how I got on the case within 24 hours, because I knew about it straight away. Whereas now, you probably wouldn't hear anything until months, weeks later.
Yeah.
So this is why I think it's such a good experience, because we've got a really clear account of what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't get to speak to the security guards because they wouldn't talk, and I don't think they ever have spoken about what happened to them.
No, I've never seen anything other than them being portrayed, as you say, famously in the Michael Aspel episode. But I've never seen them in print or on screen talking about what happened, which for me gives it a lot more credence.
Yeah. I mean, you know my website, Journalism and Folklore, I've got a story up on there and I get a lot of comments, people commenting on it. And someone claiming to be one of them, I think Stephen Goldthorpe, posted on there basically saying, oh, you know, all the stuff that's been written about this, it's a load of nonsense, you know, you weren't there, etc., etc. And I don't, you get people claiming to be people that they're not, so I don't know whether it was him, but I did actually challenge him on the message board and say, well, you tell me what happened then. You know, I was there, actually, you know, 24 hours later I actually interviewed the police officer who had his own experience, but you know, there were no response. So it could be a hoax, or I don't know, but it would be good if they would come forward and talk about it, because I think we'd learn quite a lot in addition to what we already know. But I was absolutely convinced that the police were telling the truth. And I did actually ask PC Ellis to describe what he saw, what the figure was. And he, I mean, just reading here from what he told me, he said he thought it was like somewhat in Victorian era clothes, and he did actually see his face, and he said he presumed it was a man, and it was just a man who was just staring at him, but virtually the instant he looked and he saw his face, it was gone. So he just like, and he went from one side of the car to the other. So as my colleague John was looking out of his window, I was just gazing up onto the banking, and then I turned around and shouted, and he said it was really weird. For a split second I saw his face, and it looked like he was wearing some kind of cravat and a waistcoat, like something from Dickens. But as I looked again and tried to focus, it was gone.
Yeah. I think the other aspect of this case as well, David, that sometimes gets overlooked is, yes, we know that I think one of the lads lasted three further days and then he went. And the other one lasted, I think, 3 months, but he would never go back to the site, even in the daytime.
Yeah.
But at that time, you know, let's not forget, South Yorkshire, jobs were not easy to come by. It was not the kind of place where you could just make up a silly story because you got another job to walk into.
No, you could.
Jobs were at a premium, you know, because the steelworks had closed, the pits had all gone. There was thousands of unemployed men in the area.
Yeah.
These jobs were like gold dust, which I've always thought is something that sometimes can be overlooked in the veracity of the two original witnesses' cases, because I've seen it occasionally that they're criticised for making up a story to get out of work, which just doesn't make sense if you lived in the area at the time.
No, absolutely no sense at all. No, I think they were genuinely spooked by something. What? I've no idea.
Yeah, because it's like they had two different experiences, because obviously there's the children allegedly singing Ring a Ring of Roses or whatever, because I'm not sure they ever said that. I think that's been added to it, hasn't it? That the children were clearly singing Ring of Roses. I think they were just heard children singing, didn't they?
That's right, yeah. And I did have interview someone else called who was working in the depot at the time at Deep Car, where they were doing the construction. A guy from Hillsborough, and I've got his account here, and he said that when construction work was going on, we heard kids singing on freezing cold nights, and it was very frightening. It started about 11 o'clock and continued until about 2 in the morning, almost like a small choir of about 10 or 12 kids. You couldn't tell what it was they were singing, but it was really spooky, and you always had a strange feeling that someone was watching you. So so that was going on at the time. And what the police said about the kids was, this is what Dick Ellis said that he'd been told by the security guards, is that they'd seen a group of young children playing just down from the bridge near the new road, around a pylon, not a bush, a pylon. And this was about midnight, at the same time as before. So they'd driven past these kids, parked the Land Rover, got out and found absolutely nothing there. And they examined around the pylon, which was surrounded by fresh mud with no sign of footprints. So they'd had that experience, and that was before then they saw this, whatever it is that they saw on the bridge, which, according to Dick Ellis, was some kind of monk-like figure or a headless figure or something standing on a newly constructed bridge.
Yeah. And then, obviously, the, like you say, police officers, their description is of something else entirely.
Yes, but this is what you find in these kinds of experiences, that as the story gets better and gets retold, and people, you get all these wannabes all trying to get in on the act. They try and consolidate it around a sort of a figure, like in this case it's become a monk, hasn't it?
Yes.
And there's all this stuff about there being some abbey or something nearby where some monk had sort of like died after being ejected from an abbey. It's just nonsense. There was no abbey near Stocksbridge. It was just a completely rural area. You know, there'd been no sort of graveyard there. There'd been no abbey or anything of that kind in the area where they put the bypass through.
No, not at all. Well, it's the same with the children as well, because I've seen, apparently, I think the children had all been killed in a mining accident.
That's right, mining accident, yeah.
But there's no record of that.
No. Nope.
And I don't think there was even a mine in the as close as it's made, certainly not where the road was being built.
No.
And I think then, secondly, there was I saw a story a few years ago that someone had decided to take some children for a joyful cart ride.
That's right.
And
stage
the cart
crunch.
Had overtipped, and all the children somehow died.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where that stuff came from, I have no idea. It's just people come up with these tales, don't they, to try and explain something that is inexplicable. To me, it's just a typical example. The Stocksbridge thing is not unique in that there's lots of stories, if you look in folklore, about, for example, if you go to Ireland, I remember distinctly in the 90s, I had a holiday in Ireland, and somewhere in rural Ireland, there was this weird road that just sort of like took a left turn, and there's a bush in the centre of the road.
Mm.
So, and it turned out, when I looked into it, that this is where the fairies lived.
Yes.
And when they constructed the road, they had to divert around this thorn tree or bush where the fairies lived, because by putting it through the bush, you'd disturb the fairies, and then everything would go wrong, and people would die in accidents and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that, and there's loads of stories like that all over Ireland. And I had a postgraduate student, journalism student, a few years ago, and he's from Iceland.
Yes,
and
he was constantly
telling me all these stories from his childhood about, you know, these rocks and bushes and things where the elves live in Iceland. And if they're building a road or something, they'll go miles out of the way to go around these places where these creatures live.
Yeah.
And it just strikes me that what we have here at Stocksbridge is another example of that. That what happened was is that they put this road through, and they didn't disturb any graveyard or anything, but maybe there was some kind of fairy tree or a place where, you know, these elemental creatures or whatever you want to call them, fairies, elves or something, and they were disturbed and they created all these weird experiences.
Yeah, I mean, that's always something, you know, disturb the residents of a local boggart or something like that and put him out. But I think the other thing is, as we've touched on, there's so much been added to it and padded the whole story out.
Yeah.
But I think at the time, there's a handful of brilliant witness accounts. One of my favourites is the gentleman called Graham Brooke. I think he was from Chapeltown, and he was jogging with his son. Was it Nigel?
That's right, yeah.
That's one of those witness accounts where you think, well, it's one of two possibilities. He's either lying or he saw something, because they both saw it as well.
Yeah, I've got
smelled
account
it
here, actually. Yeah, this was in, yeah, they did smell it, yeah. 1987, Graham Brooke, Chapeltown man. Yeah. Again, this was while the bypass was actually still under construction. I think he was filmed talking about this, again, by Michael Aspel.
Mm.
But his account here, I've got it here, said, I was training for the London Marathon, and my son Nigel came along for the company. We'd run up to Wortley Church, and we were coming back down to the road when we both saw a strange apparition. And this was in daylight, I think, as well.
Yes, yeah, it was.
And it was so strange that our eyes couldn't at first take it in. It was a man dressed in 18th century style clothing with a dark brown cape who carried a bag with a chain. And again, he described this same thing that the policeman described. The hair on our necks, the back of our necks, stood up on end.
Yep.
And there was a musty smell like an antique shop.
Mm. Yes.
I turned to my son and said at first that it would get knocked down because it was on the road, actually in the middle of the road, but then it just disappeared. If he had not seen it as well, this is the son he's talking about, I wouldn't have said anything because no one would have believed me. I'm not superstitious, but it was certainly an eerie experience, which I can't explain.
Yeah, and it's one of those classic ghost sightings as well, where the ghost's walking at a different level to the existing road, because apparently they could only see it from the shins up.
That's right, yeah, because which reminds me of some of those stories from York. You know,
yes,
the
Legionnaires.
Yeah, yeah, the treasurer's house. I don't know if you've been on the tour of that, Paul, but it's, if you haven't, it's well worth.
Yes, I've checked out many of York's famously haunted pubs, I'll say that much.
Yeah, yeah, so have I. But the thing that, is it English Heritage or National
yes.
Trust? I can't remember which.
Trust,
but,
I think's got it.
Yeah, but they do a fantastic ghost tour in there, and they actually take you in the cellar where this guy, I can't remember his name, is it Harry something?
Yeah, the one that saw the Legion walk through.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that to me is one of the most convincing ghost experiences in the whole sort of canon of ghost stories. This guy that was, I think he was just doing a, he was just a labourer, weren't he?
He was
messing about on a ladder or something in the cellar of this house, which is on the Roman road leading into the centre of York. I think this was in the 1950s, and he heard this horn, didn't he, blowing, and thought, what's going on here? And then these legionnaires all started pouring, coming through the road. But they were like walking along, like you were saying, you could only see them from there, from the waist up, I think, because the Roman road was at a lower level to the present-day road.
Yeah. Crazy. I
remember seeing him interviewed. I can't remember which program it was, and he was saying they all looked really pissed off.
They
were like auxiliaries, weren't they? They weren't Roman centurions. They were like local soldiers who'd been press ganged into working for the Romans, and you know, they were all sort of like eyes down, you know, sort of like as you can imagine.
Absolutely, yes, very much so. Yeah, not much of a choice, really, I think.
So, what was going on around Stocksbridge in 1987, 1988, I don't know, but there was all these people that all came forward who all had weird experiences. And the bizarre thing, like you said, Paul, is that they were all of different things.
Mm.
There wasn't one thing.
No. I mean, there are two other notable sightings as well, and I think they're about 10 years apart.
Mm.
I think you interviewed the latter one. Which was Paul and Jane Ford.
Yes, because I was at college with Jane Ford. That's how I found out about that one.
I mean, that is... there is another witness account, once again, strangely enough, by another married couple who were visiting in-laws in Stocksbridge, because I think that's what they were doing as well.
They were.
And that was Judy and David Simpson.
Yep.
And their sighting is quite frightening, because, first of all, you've got two witnesses, both seeing the same thing, driving in daytime, and essentially what they saw was a creature, well, a figure of a man in a field that caught their eye because it was waving about, and it ran up the embankment and then floated into the middle of the road, and they drove the car straight through it.
That's right, yeah, and that was very similar to what Paul and Jane Ford said that they'd seen, and I think they were actually on the bypass itself, and that was on New Year's Eve. And the thing about that was they almost crashed the car.
Yeah.
So they were so terrified. But, I mean, those two experiences are more like the classic Phantom Hitchhiker.
Yes.
Which is a classic ghost legend that you find all over the world. I mean, there's the Bluebell Hill Phantom Hitchhiker in Kent.
Yes,
This is a story that's been going on for years, in that people who don't know about the legend, who are totally unconnected with each other, keep turning up at the local police station saying, oh my God, I think we've knocked someone down on Bluebell Hill.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a figure of, I don't know whether it's a female or male, I can't remember the story from Bluebell.
Strangely enough, I was talking about this the other day on the Facebook group, and it was a girl. Was she called Jane? And she was killed in a head-on smash on coming back from her hen night.
That's right, yeah.
1962.
So that has actually been documented, has it? That
yes.
did actually happen.
It did. Yeah, it's a head-on crash. I think the crash. I'm sure. I'll send you the link later because it. There's a really good article I put on there the other day, which basically says this is when it started, and that's the event they trace it to, because apparently reports started after the accident because the girl is supposed to be the bride to be.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about that is it's the fact that she died on a hen night.
Yes.
And it's the sort of thing about it makes it even more tragic, doesn't it? Like it's a bad death.
Yes.
You know, it's sort of like someone taken away in the prime just as they're about to get married and embark on their life and all the rest of it.
Yep.
And they've been cruelly snatched away. So it's like it's the classic sort of thing where you would expect a ghost, isn't it?
Yeah, which is the kind of thing where you think, well, if anybody's going to be a ghost, it'll be her.
Yeah. So they're trying to sort of like return to the scene to do something, I don't know, to sort of rectify something or to, who knows, you know. And there's this idea that people had before the Reformation that there was this thing called purgatory where when you died, some people went straight to heaven, some people went straight to hell.
Yeah.
But then there's a whole bunch of people who were just trapped midway between the two. and that's why in the Middle Ages you get all these weird ghost stories, because they're people trapped in purgatory, and they were sort of like coming back and haunting people in order to get people who were alive to do things that would allow them to sort of move on into the next stage of the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
So
as far as I can remember, that variation of a story is the first officially recorded ghost story, I think, which was written by Pliny the Younger.
That's right, yeah.
And he basically tells this classic, you know, rattling of chains. This guy's moved into a house that nobody stays in.
That's true. Yeah, that's the one, yeah.
And the ghost points to the spot on the floor and he decides to check it out, and there's a skeleton underneath and it's buried properly and the haunting ceases. And that's 2,000 years ago.
But you see, the interesting thing about those stories, when you go back into the medieval times and the classical accounts, ghosts always had a purpose.
Yes.
You know, they were trying to sort of rectify a wrong. They were trying to move on from purgatory into the light. They were they were trying to show people where buried treasure was, that kind of thing.
Mm.
Whereas the difference today is that you get purposeless ghosts.
Yes.
You know, that don't seem to have any reason at all to be doing what they're doing.
Mm.
You know, and I think that reflects like the change in religious attitudes, because, you know, if you can actually, I mean, people have written some fantastic books. Owen Davies, History of Ghosts.
Mm.
If you read that, he just charts how ghosts, what we think of as ghosts and what we think ghosts do, has changed all through the last two millennia, in line with what we think about the world and our religious beliefs.
Yeah.
And today, you know, people don't tend to be religious. They're spiritual, but not necessarily followers of traditional religion. So the ghosts that we get are the ones we deserve, maybe.
Well, you know? Yes.
They don't have any purpose. They just swan around in front of, on bypasses, nearly causing accidents and things.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite interesting because I spoke to an author called Jeff Holder a couple of weeks ago, who did a fantastic history of poltergeists in Scotland.
Mm.
And he went back 500 years. And that was really interesting to see the cultural shift from it being some kind of religious event to, by the 18th century, they'd gone from being something connected with the church and religion to just essentially becoming ghosts.
Yes. And now they're just entertainment, aren't they?
Well, yes.
You know, I mean, it's like people took them really seriously in the past. You know, it wasn't something you'd joke about. Whereas now, you know, people, it's like, oh, it's Halloween, let's dress up as ghosts, let's watch Almost Haunted, and let's all scream and run around, but we don't really believe in them.
Mm. Well, I mean, well, I'm not too sure, but...
I'm playing devil's advocate here.
I know you are, I know you are, and good for you to do so and allow some balance to the conversation, I think. But, I mean, it is an incredible story, really, because it's... probably one of the most well-known modern ghosts, because there isn't anything that kind of predates this bypass being built.
No, there was just nothing there. It was just, like I said, virgin fields. There was nothing. There was no mine, there was no abbey, there was no graveyard. All these things have all been made up, as far as I can see. But what you did get afterwards, once the road actually opened, were then this thing about it being jinxed.
Yeah.
And bizarrely enough, I thought this had been made up at the time, but it was actually...
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
The case. It actually opened on Friday the 13th of May.
Yes,
it 1988.
It did.
And the fact was, it was badly designed. You probably drove on it, Paul, at the time. I did, and it's no wonder that there were lots of fatal accidents, because you got you were like on a dual carriageway, and suddenly you were on a single carriageway, and then you're on a dual carriageway again, and there were people sort of overtaking people on blind bends on this road. So there were some pretty horrendous crashes. I think there were, in the first few years, the first 5 or 6 years, there were 8 fatal accidents and dozens of serious crashes. And the local MP at the time was Helen Jackson. And I remember interviewing her, and she was sort of constantly trying to get it labelled as an accident black spot.
Yeah.
And as far as I could, I did some digging on this, and it was first described as having a jinx in a newspaper article in 1989. So that was 2 years after the sightings, and 1 year after it had opened.
Yeah. It is unusual. I mean, because I've seen it described as the most dangerous road in Britain. Mm. So I thought, well, you know, I live here. And if it's that bad, you'd hear a lot more about it than we do in the local area. I mean, it has got a reputation primarily because of the ghosts and this alleged jinx.
Yeah.
But I checked it. It's not even in the top 50 most dangerous roads in Britain. And it's not even in the top 5 in South Yorkshire.
No. And the reason is because they've improved it, and they've put all these cameras in, and... You know, it's improved the safety of the road. I think there was a number of accidents in the first few years.
Yes, because it was badly designed.
Badly designed, but they've rectified that, and it's a much safer road now. And so all that aspect of the legend seems to have sort of gone away.
Mm.
And now we've got all these people going up there, you know, doing YouTube videos and... You know, the usual procession of psychics who are sort of channeling this, that, and the other apparition.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, I just find that whole aspect of it just doesn't do anything for me. I just think it's just entertainment.
It is, and what I find interesting about these so-called modern experiences is that they all focus on the monk, which in all the witness reports is in one story.
It is, yeah.
Whereas the Victorian gentleman is in at least 2.
Yeah.
Never mentioned,
no.
Which I found perplexing, because it's as though they've... Now, maybe that's a cultural thing, maybe it's a fashionable thing that they've gone for the... You know, because obviously now we've got possessed nuns as one of the go-to horror icons in modern ghost and horror films. So maybe they're just trying to play on that, David. I'm not too sure, but it's interesting. Yeah. I've always found that perplexing about the case, because it's the least mentioned part of the whole, those key witnesses that we've discussed.
I think it actually stems from the first of the psychics that became involved, and the first one I'm aware of was someone called Lucinda June.
Yes,
that was a stage name. For Penistone, I believe, and her real name was June Beavers.
Yes.
And I remember doing a piece on her, and she said that she believed the ghost was a monk whose resting place had been disturbed, and that he'd been moved, or his body had been moved to unhallowed ground or something, and that's why he was haunting the bypass. And she said there's a connection between the road accidents and the ghost as well. And she described herself as a psychic agony aunt and ghostbuster.
She used to have it stuck to a car, I think. On the side doors, it had something like psychic.
That's right.
Call this number, yeah.
Yeah, because this is when Ghostbusters was popular. You know, this is before the X-Files, so it was Ghostbusters that everybody was into. But, I mean, maybe she did contact the spirit of this monk up there. Who am I to know that? But if you want to trace the origins of why the monk became the prominent sort of spirit up there, I think you can probably trace it to her story.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah,
that's... So I think she laid the foundations of that belief. But she did say, the interview I've got here with her, she said she thought there were two ghosts on the bypass. There was one at Wortley, which was just a harmless ghost.
Good.
And then there was one at Peroy Bridge, and this one was much taller, bigger and evil, and that she'd had a strong sense of fear and a musty book smell when she contacted it.
That musty smell again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So what do you think about it, Paul, then?
I mean...
You've read over the years.
I mean, I've obviously been up there a few times. And I think, especially going up there after all the initial reports, I think you go there with a preconceived idea.
Yes.
That it feels creepy. I mean, I don't like being... I mean, I obviously at that time we were teenagers, so, and in that kind of era... When one of your mates got a car, that's all you did during the week. You went out driving. Everybody chucked in a quid for petrol, and you
went
driving around the area because you were young men out with a bit of freedom for the first time. That's what you did. So, obviously, that sort of late 80s, early 90s period, we probably went up and down there more times than I care to remember, purely based on this reputation it had. And to be fair, we saw some pretty dangerous driving. You know, people overtaking on blind corners and all sorts.
Yeah. Absolutely, so did I when I used to go up there. Because I used to drive, I used to quite often, girlfriend at the time, we used to drive up there at night. This is what people used to do. And I'd go behind Wortley, up onto Green Moor, and then there's like a road that takes you actually down onto the bridge.
Mm.
So you can actually drive over that bridge and park on the bridge and go and stand and watch the traffic zooming underneath.
Yes.
So I used to do that regularly. And just sit there and, you know, the usual thing, waiting for something to happen that never did.
Yeah. No, exactly. And I think it's one of those roads as well that because of, especially if you're driving out of Sheffield towards Stocksbridge and Stocksbridge is on your left, all you've got in front of you really is the moors coming up. So it gives it a certain look as well. It's the environment and the way the foliage is and the hills and things. It looks as though it's the perfect place for something weird to kind of hang about.
That's right, yeah, and you can see aircraft going into Manchester Airport, so, you know, there's a UFO thing as well. And there were various people came forward and said they'd had UFO sightings in that area around the same time. I remember there was one guy who'd, I think he spoke to Peter Huff, the guy who collected stories over in Manchester, and he around the same time had had some kind of UFO abduction in the Langsat area. And that got roped into it as well, I seem to remember.
Yes, well, yeah, it's a prime little... It's one of those places, I think, Sheffield, that it's got quite a lot of weird ghost things and UFOs flying about. But we haven't had a real modern kind of story to get his teeth into. You know, we obviously had the strange UFO incident in 94 where people thought they saw something on fire flying over Sheffield and blowing up in the moors. And,
that one, yeah.
And then you got Stocksbridge and then... a couple of others, but there's nothing else really sort of come out over the last few years, really, which is a bit of a shame.
No, there's no other experiences from that area that are as dramatic and as convincing as the ones from the 80s that that people have come forward with. I mean, I've got a whole box file here full of letters that people have sent me over the years with different experiences, but they're all talking about things that happened in the past.
Yeah.
You know, in the 70s and 50s and before that, they're not, as far as I'm aware, I mean, I think that sighting by Paul and Jane Ford, which was in the late 1990s, that's the last one I remember from that area. And the weird thing was, I was at I was at college with Jane because she was a trainee journalist, mm-hmm. same time as me. And the other witness you mentioned, Judy Simpson, I used to work with her in the local paper at Stocksbridge. There was a paper called the Stocksbridge Trader I worked at. Mm. So it's weird that all these key witnesses all are connected with me. If I wanted to get paranoid, I could easily sort of think, oh my God, is the ghost sort of following me around and appearing to all my friends?
Well, it's that famous Fortean coincidence that begins once you dip your toe in this water, David, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, it'd be interesting to see if anyone listening to your show actually knows anything else about this or has got some additional information. I'm always interested to hear from people who have got a genuine experience to tell.
Mm. I mean, it is something I obviously keep my eye out for anything local in regards to this kind of thing, because obviously I'm deeply mystified by it, and I love a good ghost story. But we seem to be coming up a bit short, which is a shame really, because we could do with some more exciting ghosts in the area, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
So well, listen, thank you very much for delving back into your early days of your career and pulling out some of those pieces of information for us. It's been brilliant covering.
I can't believe that this was 30 years ago.
Well, that's the other thing.
That's the most disturbing thing of all.
It is. It's one of those things. It's something I've been aware of my entire adult life, and it seems like it doesn't seem that long ago.
Yeah, I know. And there were loads of programs made about it in the 90s. There was the Michael Aspel thing. I think there was another TV documentary that was made a few years after that was quite good as well.
Yeah.
But very little since.
Yeah, yeah, I haven't seen anything. I think that one was about Haunted Roads. I think the other one that covered Stocksbridge, and that was pretty creepy, that, because that had a guy who got a haunted hitchhiker story on it.
Yeah, and there did used to be I don't know if it still exists, but there was a guy who actually had a website on Haunted Roads and Phantom Hitchhikers. He did a whole series of articles for Fortean Times, I think around late 90s, early noughties.
Yeah.
And you come to realise that it's not something that's unique to this area. That there are similar legends in different places all around the country. I mean, you may remember from reading some of these folklore books about that case in Dartmoor in the 1920s.
Yes.
You know, the hairy hands.
Yes, grabbing hold of the steering wheel.
Yeah, and various people, I think, died in accidents there. You know, there was a charabanc that turned over and people were killed. Mm. And various people came forward and said it was because they'd been driving along and these, like, hairy hands had appeared and grabbed the steering wheel and threw them off the road. Yeah. And again, I think the local council investigated it, and it turned out that there was a weird camber on the road at the point where all these accidents had happened. So was it a case that there were simple accidents caused by the way the road was designed, and then people read all this supernatural stuff into it because it was Dartmoor, you know, with the Hounds of the Baskervilles and all the rest of it? Or was there a genuine some kind of presence there that was trying to warn people, you know, that this was a dangerous road? There's no easy answers, is there?
Absolutely. That story terrified me, because the first time I read that, I think I was about 8 years old. And it was a cold, wet, stormy night on the Welsh coast. We were on holiday in a caravan there. And I was laid in a little bunk bed with a little light on, with the wind howling. And I'm reading that, these hairy hands. And I had nightmares of hairy hands tapping on the caravan window that night. I remember it so well.
This is because of things like that. That's why we've grown into the adults that we've become.
Absolutely.
We're obsessed with all this weird stuff.
Absolutely. Well, it was very nice to see the Usborne World of the Unknown Ghosts re-released recently, and I obviously bought a copy because
so did I.
£5.75. You can't go wrong, I think. Yeah. And it was just honestly, it's one of the first things I can remember as a child is reading this book and laughing at it, because it was literally like stepping back in time 40 years.
Yep, yep. I remember reading the UFO one.
Yes.
Which was equally good, and I hope they're going to reissue that as well, because it was reading that when I must have been about 7 or 8 that put me on the road to ufology, really.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there was one on monsters as well, wasn't there?
There was. I'm hoping they're going to reissue that as well.
Yeah, I think, because it's been an absolutely outstanding success, hasn't it? Because I think it was like a petition that got it started, and it, you know, it's sold by the bucket load. So, you know, fair play to them. I hope so.
Yeah, I mean, they deserve some kind of award for you know, so the, what for services to the childhood imagination.
I absolutely, that should be given it. Mysterious World, I think.
Absolutely, yeah.
So then, obviously, I think that kind of covers everything, and I'll kindly put your interviews with the police officer at the end, so people can listen to that if they want, if they've got bored of us talking about being in Yorkshire and ghosts.
It's not fantastic quality, is it? But I mean, no. I think if you play them a few little excerpts from it, then I think people will get the idea. And it's got quite a bit of an atmosphere to it, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It does get the hair standing up on the back of your neck, because you're essentially listening to a police officer talking about seeing a ghost.
Absolutely, and I think it's far better that people listen to some primary evidence like that rather than the rantings of these people from YouTube that know nothing.
Absolutely. So, what are you doing these days to keep yourself busy? Because obviously you've kind of moved on from the world of UFOs and things like that. And obviously, I know you're trying to collect the world's most possessed painting.
That's a story that keeps giving, that one.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, setting up this folklore centre at Hallam is absorbing most of my time, and we're hoping at some point to be able to put on a master's course in contemporary legend, but it's going to be another year or so before we get that off the ground, because these things take a lot of work.
Absolutely.
We're also working on John Widdowson, who used to run the Folklore Centre at the University of Sheffield. He's donating all his archive to us at Hallam, so right. Huge amount of material there that we've got to somehow get transferred from his farmhouse in Derbyshire to the library at Hallam, so that's going to occupy us. And the other thing is, I keep saying I'm leaving UFOs behind, but there's a colleague of mine called Richard Wilson, not the one who says I don't believe it.
Yes,
another Richard Wilson.
Absolutely.
He's a TV journalist, and he's as far gone as I am on this stuff. And he's been he's got a mate called Jim Chisholm, who's British Online Archives. You know the guy who did the podcast with me a few months ago.
Yeah.
And he's got this idea. He wants us to do a series of short documentaries that we're going to make in the TV studio at Hallam on UFOs, sort of educational sort of documentaries, but we're going to use fancy music and some special effects, and almost sort of like try and sort of take the piss out of some of the American TV productions, you know, the over the top sensational things, but try and do it seriously. And we've got a few UFO witnesses lined up who are willing to sort of be interviewed, and we're going to do some historical stuff as well. So look out for that, and it's going to be called UFO Lore. So it will have its own YouTube channel at some point early in 2020.
Fantastic! I'll certainly keep my eyes out for that. But because I was fortunate enough to come to your fantastic conference in September, which was a really good couple of days. It was fantastic and fascinating.
Yeah, Folklore on Screen.
Yes, brilliant. And I mean, it was just such a smorgasbord of topics. There was just so much going on. It was brilliant. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Took a lot of work to organise, and we've had a lot of people saying, "Oh, you need to make this an annual event." But it literally took a year of planning to actually put that on, just 2 days. So we will be doing other events, and I think we've got an idea for a one day. Conference on folk traditions sometime next year. So you'll be the first to hear about it.
Marvellous. I look forward to it. Fantastic. Well, good luck with both of those endeavours, and keep me informed, as I know you will. Where can everybody find your musings and any of your work?
Well, if they want to look on my personal website, which is called Folklore and Journalism, you'll find me at www.drdavidclark.co.uk. But also check out our fantastic Contemporary Legend website, which is centreforcontemporarylegend.com.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and it's on Facebook as well.
It is, and that is we've got our own Facebook page and Twitter handle as well. So the Centre for Contemporary Legend is where it's at the moment for me.
Brilliant. Right. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really good to go over our most famous local legend. for a bit of time. So, brilliant. Thanks for your time and your conversation today.
No, thanks for inviting me on, and happy Halloween to everybody.
Happy Halloween indeed. Take care. See you later.
See you, Paul. Cheers. Bye.
As we mentioned in the interview, Dr. Clark has kindly allowed us to play some of the original interviews back when he spoke to the two police officers in September 1987. Now, the sound quality's not brilliant, because these were recorded on original audio cassettes on a ghetto blaster in a police station in 1987. So unfortunately, the first few minutes aren't very audible, so I've chopped them out. So the conversation starts after about 8 minutes into the interview. But I think if you listen carefully, and maybe turn it up a little bit, you'll certainly get an idea of what happened to those two police officers and just how baffled they were by what happened to them that night. Have a great Halloween. Take care and enjoy these interviews.
But as I said, what was so weird about it was the way I felt before anything happened. Somebody just walked along and made me jump. Because I accepted it, but I knew before it all happened that something was wrong, that something was amiss.
Eventually went from your side of the car to my side of the car at the same time, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
He didn't know with Deke as well. Shadow around with me. No, I didn't. No, not at all, because as Deke was looking out of his window, I was just gazing up onto the banking. And I just turned to Deke and I said, Deke, and I turned and there's this chap just stood there next to the car. And then Deke said, you know, he seen him, and, you know, really weird.
You see, you could see about someone from his way.
I don't. All I know is, as I say, you imagine we've got a Vauxhall Astra, which, for a small car, a fairly big arm, would be well schooled, be well set up. So, you think if I was still on the side of a Vauxhall Astra close by in the window, you would perhaps see so much, or perhaps a little less of whoever was stood there. Now, all I saw was whatever was there, albeit it could have been a man, it could have been a woman, it could have been anything. But it definitely formed the impression of it being a person.
Yeah.
To me, a man.
Yeah, like a dog had run past and jumped up and looked through a window. There was no way it was that. It was definitely...
I think it was kind of cold in a way. Well,
to me, what I saw of him, it sort of connected with something like 1820s, that era. But I just looked at his face, which I presume was a man. He was just literally staring. But obviously, we both looked again, he was gone.
That's you saw his face as well, wasn't it?
For a split second, his face, yeah. And to me, looking what I saw in my dress, it looked like a cravat on and a waistcoat. And to me, it looked like something like that, a Dickens beard and all like that. But of course, you look again to try and focus, because it was gone. It was
folded, no. The only thing I would say is probably if you were stood there in the middle of the night, I could have confused him with you, because all I remember seeing was a V here. Which I put down when John said straight to a waistcoat, but looking at you, it could have been a V next to him.
Yeah.
I put it down and seen a V, light clothing. You see, it could have been like everybody relates white to a ghost. But what actually I saw, which was whether it was a waistcoat, a jumper, or whatever, was light colour. But bearing in mind, everybody said, ah, but we're talking about midnight, half 12. But we're full moon and no other street lighting around. You know yourself how light it can get once you're out of this.
I think it's happened so quick.
Mm-hmm.
It's on sight of the time. So it's difficult for you to remember.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get your subconscious, but it's like that.
I don't know. You see, it says subconscious, we've written the fact off that what we've seen moving up by the bridge was anything. We've put that down to light.
Yeah. Well,
and what we see,
That's subconscious, I mean, what you saw was in the subconscious. You know, I mean, the chance that you did see it, but people do see these things, just especially the legends and the
things.
So what did you conclude about the thing you saw moving? Did you conclude it wasn't a light?
That's what we concluded. Yeah. You see, the only thing we couldn't understand about what we watched moving was why, the third time, why there was nothing there. You see, it could be, we could have written it off to it, they could have been doing something in one of the furnaces, they could have been doing something in one of the shops, they could have all these steel buildings which cast lights up, they could have been doing anything. But what was so strange was on the third occasion, which we're only still talking about a matter of 10-15 minutes difference, is that there was nothing there.
Yeah,
now you can understand why it disappears when you put carrot lights on it, because it obviously throws a different shadow. But The reason it didn't look like any lights from the works, if you really think about it, it was as though it was something physical or something moving across.
It was coming towards it, didn't it?
It was going, it was as though something was actually walking around the box, although you couldn't, we were only 100 yards away, 150 yards at the most, so had there been a person walking around the box, you wouldn't have identified it as, what's that bloke walking around, but you couldn't. It just didn't, it looked more like shadows being cast from something.
Is there any trees on the box?
No.
I just wondered if more,
The only thing what it could have cast shadows from, but there again it wouldn't make it move like that, is on their power cables, but there was no wind, so they wouldn't be moving. And you see, that was another thing we put down to. We looked on the Saturday night when we went up, me and John, we looked on the bridge when we parked up above the bridge in the car and we shone the headlights onto the bridge, and on the bridge itself were large sheets of polythene. Now again, you see, we thought, security men frightened themselves. They've gone up on a windy night, one of these sheets of polythene just stood straight up and they thought they'd seen someone. Because I don't say I'm a non-believer, because I do, because, you know what I mean, I'm fairly interested in things like this, but we've gone up obviously with an open mind. We haven't gone up to scare on this stuff, because we've written it up as numerous different things. Like I mentioned, we put the kids down to the sheet. As soon as we'd seen the polythene sheeting, we'd said, oh, we've seen this polythene sheet. But we thought, you've got to sit there and give a blow to them into the down. And look where it's got us. Everybody thinks we're absolutely bloody crazy. But it's... But what's so interesting since, we've had a lot of people come forward who've seen things. We've only come forward because somebody else, as they say, has admitted it.
What, in that same area?
In this area. Some years back, I don't know whether you know about it, but I don't know how many years back we're now, possibly 8-10 years. There was a very funny door for the Silver Fox at the pub, with the supposed poltergeist or something, when all the furniture were moving about and the food at the wedding reception was being eaten and everything. But one strange one is that some people keep seeing a monk floating about. Now, going back on monks, I've spoken to a bloke who's in this, into Cavaliers and Round Edge and all that lot. He's really into local history. And apparently, going back to the 12th, 13th century, there were a lot of monks out here. Now, whether that's something to do with them, we've had reports of, we've no idea how long ago, and I've not had this confirmed, but I've heard this from two or three different people. The pine one we were parked just down from, some young themselves from it about 100 years ago. Now, I've had that from two or three different people, but we've not been able to clarify that. There's nothing that shows, and the main local historian around here, a bloke called Jack Branson, says he knows nothing, says he knows nothing at all about strange deaths up here. But I have heard it from all different people. Local pub where we go, somebody came up to me and said, "Aye, you will be at Parliament, won't you?" It's where that bloke hung himself so many years back. So you just don't know.
Whereabouts of this monk we see?
It's been seen as far and wide as Pinkle Street, which is back over this side, when I look towards Wordley, and all the way along. Now, a lady who was addressed, I'll dig it out in a bit, she apparently worked in the Bank Road, which is here.
That one here, which is at the end of the back, that's where the man comes around here.
According to her, there was a monk who lived in a cottage near here about 100 years ago, who did work for the guardian of things and replacement for pool. Now, she said that his last wish was to be buried on consecrated ground, but there's been no record of his death. I've gone around all the local churches, Roman Catholic, you name it, and with no reports of anybody of his faith, etc., being buried in any of these graveyards for about the last 200-300 years. So, local legend has it with him that when they found him dead, they just go and chucked him in it. So he could have been chucked anywhere on that bank. Now, we've done everything else we've done. This area is littered with mines. There's never been a fatal accident in any of our mines. Because all the mines have been opened up for the bypassing caps. But we've never had a fatal accident in any of the mines. We've not had any fatal road accidents on P. Roy Lane, but we know better. somebody mentioned about a Fabian chap supposedly being involved in an accident years and years and years ago. But that could be us. We've not turned anything up further about any deaths. It's just local rumours, legends about this bloke hanging himself and about this mum.
There's also the
transfer
of children.
It's not a tree, it's a pylon.
Oh, it's a pylon.
It's a pylon of a tree.
The star, he thought that wrong.
Yeah, they got three. As I said, what is this? This report. This report I did, I was told by my boss to submit this report, just in case the star anybody got hold of it. As happens with our job, as you can imagine, this will be classed as quite amusing. So it's filtered around and quite a few people have read it, and obviously one of the people who has read it has run the star. Or, as happens every day, the star ring us, asking if anything's going up, and somebody's have thought, oh, I have to tell them about this. And they relate it to things in here, that, and they haven't read it properly, they just thought, what's he said, and he said so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so. But this tree don't exist, it's a pylon we're dancing around. You see that again, you could write a fantastic electricity. You know, you're not really able to set a watch the power on late at night. You do have a tendency to... especially with it being right at the back of the gate with steelworks, there's a lot of static flying about here and everywhere. We're directly below the great big radio mast, aren't we, where we're sat? You know what I mean? We've got every form of energy coming from every source conceivable where we were.
The thing is, we don't seem connected
to man.
No.
You see, I would have rolled it up. If I'd have been on my own, I'd have rolled it up as myself scaremongering myself, set up there, driving myself half stupid.
Yeah.
But the two things that didn't concern me, because it didn't, you see, again in the start it said that we'd been disturbed. I will admit at the time it kind of made me jump and I thought, something's wrong, but I wouldn't say that we didn't sleep about it because. As soon as I got home that night, I took my dog for a walk and I went through these woods at the back. So, you know, it didn't frighten me. I didn't think, I'm not without it again in the only dark. It didn't frighten me at all afterwards. But the two things that concerned me were the fact that, firstly, how I felt before something happened, which I've never experienced before, feeling like that. And secondly, the fact that we both saw it virtually at the same time, at the speed that it went from me seeing it here to John seeing it here. If John hadn't seen it, I would have never thought to look at his side of the car. But this, you know what I mean? How on earth it got from one side to the other, whatever it was.
Are you interested in this stuff? Have you had any kind of experience like that before?
No.
No involvement to go?
I thought I had, but where I felt that night, I would say no. I've seen some plenty of strange things. We all see strange things when you go back through the number of years of work nights. But I wouldn't say I've never...
You've got a lot job to see strange things, actually, aren't you? But I wonder, you know, to make something fancy.
No, really.
There's any lot of strange things happening in this valley, or what do you mean by that?
Just by, as I said, the number of sightings we've had. You see, this place, if we're going to really go into it, we've had this place is supposedly haunted, isn't it? We've had numerous reports from here. Bobby's here, I've said the bad things at night. Seen things. But you know, yourself in large old buildings, with a fire when you're on your own, you don't need it.
But to see things, that's good.
But there was something definitely there. You can't write it up as a big thing there, there was definitely something there.
How do you think about it? You're not bothered with it,
I wasn't bothered that night. We went straight back up. We would have sat there. What I want to do again is, as we've said, once we clear up and once everybody, the interest in it died down, we're going to go back up again. Because the funny thing was, when we had this report, we'd been sat in one day and we'd been laughing and joking about it, and we'd said what's going to happen if this damn thing approaches, and I said, yeah, I can't even speak to it. But with it happening, or with something happening, it worried us, I wouldn't say worried, you know what I mean, it just frightened you, didn't it? No two ways about it.
Too soon.
But as I say, we want to go back up because I think if it happens again, you don't know whether you can cope with it. Then again, you might be expecting it, so you'll probably find yourself half to death again if it's like a steam roll.
But I don't think I can do as much.
You see, as I said, that was the only thing that didn't frighten me, but the only thing that really got to me that night was the way I felt. That did put heebie-jeebies or whatever you want to call it, that did bottle me a bit of the way I felt. They were very upset. They were extremely upset. They were... That's the news we ever come to with seeking sanctuary as bloody church. It was as bad as that. You see, this is what we mainly thought was ironic about it, was the fact that it had been passed to us to deal with, because what on earth was the right place? It was a church who were passing it to us, you know what I mean? Surely it's place, not even a church, it's a place.
We spoke to this Stuart Brindon, what's his views on the subject?
He played it very low key. To be quite frank, he didn't know what to do, so he thought, oh, we're in. And what do you know when you don't have to do in place?
So he didn't actually do an exit of it?
No, he doesn't it now. No, he's left it with us. The old Aegon story, I'll leave it with you. He wishes now he had done. That's not
Is it possible to speak to these security men, or are they too upset to speak about it?
No, they'll speak to you about it, but they don't have any. I'll keep the phone and we can straight to you, or anything you like.
You see, in your case, you're looking, you've seen something that's probably startled your time, and you go, you can think back and move around, but you will walk to work in it. But if there's something happening in your own house, you can't go to work in it.
This is it, as I tried to explain to them. I said, well, you know, it didn't hurt in any way. The one with the silver fox was the weirdest I have ever heard of in my life. Now, somebody could have got hurt, because actually on one of the nights, if it's true, went wrong or said it, whatever it was, turned the wardrobe on and you're in bed. And there was the one where they locked the reception room upstairs and went up the way no one would be. We're going back some years there, but you see that left when he went there, the Troy was in now, why he's had no problems at all.
Was that in the start as well?
There was a big spur, there was a big spur about that in the start, yeah.
It was also for landing. I used to the young landlord, actually, the chap I used to work with, the landlord was somewhere.
Being in touch with you, who said they've seen things. Has anybody seen anything at the same place?
No, not really. There's been a few who said they've seen things on Peterhead Lane, but you'll see when we walk, it's a weird place.
So I've been at one
time, yeah. About to come. It's a weird place because of all the reflections you've got from the works, this, that, and the other. Now, the only other thing, but there again, we should talk about DJ and the family. The brother, who was also a policeman who lives up here as well. We both, Bart and I live at this end of the pub. We both used to live at the far end. And there's a dog handler, so he takes his dog up on the new road as I used to do, as I still do, take the dogs along. And they were up near the bridge one night. There was him, his wife, and a new child and the dog. And the brother saw somebody down by the bridge. So he just went there to see who it was, like you do on our job, being inquisitive. And when they got down there was nothing. And the dog didn't even sense that anybody did. Now people say, well, that can't be right, because surely animals are more susceptible to these types of things, which are very difficult. But see, they saw somebody, and when they went down there was nothing there, and the dog didn't even pick the sense if there had been anybody there, which is most unusual.
Of course, I understand all.
No. See, we thought that when people mentioned, I thought of that the next time I go up and take my dog up and just sitting back at Banner Open and see. People have mentioned that dogs are more susceptible.
We're getting on with the warming of dogs.
Yeah. You see, they've always mentioned, because we've got, well, two cats now, we've got one cat now. But I often sit and watch cats in fascination, because they'll walk into a room, and then they'll look at something, and just walk around something, and they'll sit and just go like that, as nothing was past them. And some of these programmes I've watched, like Arthur C. Clarke and all these, they're saying that cats can see things, spirits moving around, and cats actually just sit and watch. So you don't know. So I thought to take a dog up and eat dog up, but we have my dog's that Irish son, we're probably doing a cat. Use it, doesn't it? I have traps everywhere to use. No, so as I said, we can't. John's so more it than me, but I just say we're definitely a curse. Male, female, I ain't got a clue.
Today, I think we're a male.
Yeah, I think we're a champ. As opposed to the women.
Yeah.
This has come to a thinking place, so I guess we can move.
That might be an idea. This is the leader,
It was, you know, a pallet box is what the Irish. It was just a square wooden. It was a square pallet box that had been painted white.
Yeah, moving from side to side, it's essentially coming towards us, isn't it? Essentially, like coming towards us. But as soon as you put lights in it, it's
as soon as you put lights in it, it's going to be off. Quite easy to be in shape. But what we couldn't, we knew we, although we drove up twice in the car, we knew we were in the exact same spot, because where we were parked, there was a wooden stake in the floor with a marking out for the road. And we parked in exactly the same place each time with a wooden stake, virtually right next to the car. So we knew that we were sat in the same place. And it was just so strange that on the third time, because we both literally said it at exactly the same time, that's all. There's no moving up there, I mean, that box.
Well,
we never know, Will, so there's no looking at Land Rover if you like.